There were a couple things from last week that I wanted to address still. One statement I made, which was fairly technical, which I just want to make sure wasn't misunderstood. I mentioned the question of whether the feeling that many people have, ourselves included, that there's a lack of dynamism in contemporary halakha. The halakha is not as responsive to changing circumstances as it once was historically. And I said that there are two possible ways to understand that. Either that there's more change and we're as responsive as we were, and therefore, instead of responding to 2 out of 10 cases, we're only responding to 2 out of 100, leaving 80 cases unresponded to. Or I said that perhaps, in fact, that maybe there's not... I mean, I think it's hard to argue that there's not many more changes that we encounter in modern society than we did 500 years ago. But I said that perhaps it's that we're actually going and becoming more conservative. So if there's 100 cases, we're only, in fact, responding to 10. I just wanted to point out that the numbers that I gave were purely things that I threw in the air. And if I were to give proportions, I would say that traditionally... the rabbis responded to a majority of cases as opposed to a minority of cases. So the 2 versus 8 was something strictly haphazard that I threw out and not meant to be understood literally. And if, you know, I don't want to throw out percentages, but let's at least say that the rove historically, I think that most historical change that was encountered that affected halakha was responded to by the rabbis historically. My belief is that's not the case in the last 100 years and perhaps beyond that. But certainly, this conservatizing trend has become, I think, even more severe, if you want to see it in negative terms. Some people might see it in positive terms, but I think it's become heightened, the trends towards conservatism, which I don't know to what extent we'll discuss today. Next week we're going to be talking about the conservative agenda. Conservative small c, meaning conservative as opposed to liberal, which brings us to the other thing that I wanted to address, which is conservative large c, the difference between conservative psak and orthodox psak. And people get very excited about that. I'm not really sure why. Both ways, people get, I guess it sounds controversial, I'm not sure what the point is. Yehuda sent me an article from Tamar Ross, where she speaks about how American orthodoxy is very ingrained in building up the walls. Where do we stop and the conservative movement starts? There may be something to that. From my perspective, I'm... again, living in a situation, I once wrote an article called Post-Denominationalism. To me, when I speak of post-denominationalism, the fact is that I'm not really concerned with labels so much, because I think the key question is not really what makes a psak conservative versus orthodox, as what makes a psak halachically successful versus one that's not halachically successful. We're talking in the macro terms. I'm not looking, if you're talking about looking for an individual posek, it's not really what we're talking about in this context. What we're talking about is who is going to be writing psak halacha that historically is going to be taken up by the Jewish people, is going to be given not just legitimacy, but is going to have an impact. That people will follow this particular decision or this particular person. So therefore, I don't think the question is that important. I mentioned before that there was a rabbi at Yeshiva University who gave us a conservative psak to study. And he wasn't doing it to try to be controversial. He felt that the person who wrote this particular tshuva wrote the best tshuva or the most useful tshuva in the context. I mentioned before, he's talking about cheese, right? The conservatives have a more lenient position. In that particular case, there's nothing that made that psak halacha conservative as opposed to orthodox, except for the fact that it was written by a conservative rabbi. In that sense, I'm not sure it's that different from Rabbi Mendel Shapiro's article on women's aliyot. In that sense, I think there is a difference between halachic research and a gufei Torah. In other words, halachic research, if it's correct, is correct. Ultimately, if a conservative rabbi were to present an Orthodox rabbi with the information, the Orthodox rabbi says it's correct, so then it's correct. I mean, ostensibly, a person who has enough knowledge can be posek for themselves. And if someone who's not Orthodox does the research for you, it doesn't automatically posel the tshuva, or as I said, the halachic research that's given, at least from my perspective. Again, there are certain issues that separate us from conservative Judaism, but I don't think they really play much of a role in this particular question. Sometimes they do. Sometimes tshuva, when the rabbinic assembly says, we can go against a rabbinic decree that was given by the Beit Din in the time of the Talmud. So traditionally, people have not done that. There's a reason people have not done that. And when they choose to do that, we obviously can't go along with that. That's not playing the halachic game. That's going outside of the structure that we recognize as binding. But beyond that, obviously, theological issues, which rarely play in to halacha, to psak halacha. What it does play into, and I think the critical reason that we distance ourselves from conservative halacha, I mean, I think the biggest reason is political. I mean, practically speaking, the biggest reason is political. The second biggest reason is because most of their tshuvot are fairly poor in quality. In other words, the scholarship is not on the level. Most, and there's good reasons for that. I'm not saying across the line. Obviously, there have been, and there may still be, some serious talmidei chachamim in the conservative movement. And, you know, again, whether I'm correct about this, I grant you, the last tshuva that I saw in any serious way was the tshuva that I saw in Cheese some 20-some years ago. But from what I saw then and from what I know, the quality is not. If you take the best of what Orthodox has to offer and the best of conservative has to offer, I think we don't have anything to be embarrassed about. But all of that is really, in my mind, secondary, because ultimately the question is not what makes a conservative tshuva and what makes an Orthodox tshuva. Ultimately, the question is what's going to make for a successful tshuva historically. And the question really gets back to the discussion on women's aliyot and the tshuvot that some of us looked at, hopefully most of you have got a chance to look at, from Rabbi Mendel Shapiro and Rabbi Yehuda Henkin and from Rabbi Daniel Sperber. So when we ask about these tshuvot, we want to know not so much are they orthodox, which was the question that Rabbi Gidon Rothstein sort of intimated. You know, he in the email that I sent you, the part of the article that didn't get into Tradition magazine, he accuses their tshuvot of being outside of orthodoxy. I'll speak more about what he might have been referring to. But I think that's really ultimately not the question. Even if he is correct, and I don't, again, my opinion is I don't think that the tshuvot are outside of orthodoxy, although, again, I'll try to explain what he's trying to say by that. But I think the real question about these tshuvot are, can they be historically successful? In other words, will a significant portion of the Jewish community rely upon these tshuvot? That's really the question. And I'm using this only as an example, because my real question is not so much about women's aliyot, as if I'm really completely uninvolved in that situation. It doesn't affect my community. I'm not particularly interested by it. But my very great interest is on the larger scale. What type of posek, what type of halachic decisions are likely to be accepted, and what sort of decisions are not likely to be accepted? What sort of people are not? Yeah.
I hear what you're saying, not a paradox, but a problem, in that you're saying it doesn't matter what about conservatives or liberals or mean anything. All that matters is what's the bias to become part of the Jewish community. The question is how you define that community.
Right, good, okay.
And to me, that's the entire question. Because you define the community broadly enough to conclude Orthodox and conservative
right.
people,
okay, good.
Then suddenly all the people that you wouldn't even probably consider as being, you know, acceptable, even without the labels.
Right. Okay, good. Fine, okay. So, I don't know if you got a chance to read the essay that I wrote, I sent out to... Okay, so... one of the things is a footnote. So you have to read it completely. There's a footnote about the term Catholic Israel, right? Which, again, I only know from secondary sources. Conservative movement is not of great interest to me. The term was coined. Catholic, by the way, not meaning it's Catholic versus Jewish, right? Catholic meaning universal, which is the source. Sorry? Right, which it was, right, I mean, Catholicism was the general church, the universal church. So Solomon Schechter, who was the rector, the director of the Jewish Theological Seminary, very interesting person, coined the term in order to define his vision of then emerging conservative Judaism. And what he said, and what I say is similar, which is why I had to, I mean, I'm not the first person to say it, in Orthodoxy, you have traces, you have very strong echoes of this in Rav Kook, you have in some of the Hasidic leaders before him. Solomon Schechter wanted to say that how do you judge halacha, how do you judge what constitutes acceptable Jewish practice, it's what a majority of the Jewish people take upon themselves. So the question was asked to him also. The exact question that you asked me was asked to him, who are Jews? Who is the Jew? I mean, here we're not talking about halachic Jews, obviously. We're talking about some level of commitment. But then, once you're talking about a level of commitment, there's necessarily going to be a gray area. So he avoided the question, essentially, from what I understand, again, from secondary literature. I wrote a note that was clearly, I'm not going to answer it completely, because I'm not sure it can be answered completely, but I wrote in the note about my disagreement with Solomon Schechter that a majority of apparently committed Jewry is not enough. And what I would say is that the historical decision of the Jewish people is something that you can only know 200 years later. Okay? Which I think, again, what's at stake here is doing the best we can. We can't know the future. We can't... In anything. Any course you take, whether it be in defense, whether it be in politics, you know, we're having a sociological discussion in the previous class. No one can really know. You have to take the data that's available to you and your intuitions, and do the best job you can with the nitunim, with the data that you have in front of you. So I think when we're talking about committed Jewry, the bottom line is going to be who is going to have committed great grandchildren. That's really what defines the Jewish people in terms of, I don't like the term Catholic Israel, even if it's not talking about Catholicism. I use the term that's more rooted in our own tradition, B'nai Nevi'im. That's the term that I use. That Jewish people, in fact, have an intuitive sense that has Kedusha, that's connected to the divine will, and that they essentially decide, in this particular case, they essentially decide whether women are going to have aliyot, or not aliyot, well, by the way, obviously it doesn't have to be today, it may be 100 years from now, maybe 200 years from now, but is this going to be viewed as a legitimate strain of halakha, right, even if it's not accepted as the dominant psak, is going to be considered gufei Torah in the future, that people will look back 20 years from now, 50 years from now, 200 years from now, and say there was a tshuva or discussion of Rabbi Yehuda Henkin, Rabbi Daniel Sperber, both, you know, these people, by the way, are people of stature. Hey, one can discuss. Maybe they're, you can have all sorts of critiques of them, but Rabbi Shapira, even though he wrote the longest and most involved piece, is not someone who's known to the halachic world. It's not someone who's a major rabbi. The other two are people of standing. Are they gedolim? I'm not in position to judge. But the question is, are their tshuvot going to be gufei Torah, or are they going to be halachic research, which has ultimately no more historical standing than a tshuva, the average tshuva of a conservative rabbi? Again, not meaning that they're wrong, but they're not accepted. And in the article that I wrote, I mean, it's interesting, what makes the question that one asks is, well, how does one get the stature of, because obviously, I just mentioned two people as opposed to another one. I said, these people have some stature and this person doesn't have stature. Well, how do you get such stature, historically? And authority has very little to do, and as sanctioned authority, being the rabbi of a community, or being the head of the Moetzet Gedolei Torah, right? For example, Rav Shach, who was considered to be the leader of Haredi Judaism in Israel, maybe in the world, wrote very little in terms of halakha. So historically, certainly in terms of his halachic influence, is very little. Right? Who are the people? And yet he was politically the high man on the totem pole. Right? So it's not necessarily a question of political authority or even rabbinic positions. Right? It's well known that the Chafetz Chaim didn't have smicha for most of his life, and yet he became the authority from that particular time period, the person with who carries the greatest halachic weight. Essentially, it comes out that halachic authority is very democratic, or at least in a Hegelian sort of way, where the historical forces determine that which is the best. And numbers that accrue, meaning Rav Moshe Feinstein has a famous story where someone asked him, you know, how did you become famous? Why do so many people write to you from all over the world, all over the United States? So he said, it all started, someone asked me a question. I mean, he was a rabbi of a town in Europe, maybe more than one. Someone asked me a question, he liked the answer. So he told his friend. Right? He came to me, he also asked me a question, he also liked it. He told his friend. So I think on a very simple level, I think there's a lot of truth to that here you have a situation where people, again, the sort of bnei nevi'im within us, elects who is the posek ador, who are accepted poskim, who are people of stature. What are we looking for? I mean, there's an interesting little note in I think it was Rav Lichtenstein's piece, quoting Rav Avram Shapiro, who just passed away last year, where he mentioned that traditionally mekelim have advantages over machmirim. That, you know, the business of the person who asked Rav Moshe the question liked the answer. Well, most people like lenient answers more than stringent answers. Historically, though, it's not always true, by the way, and especially in our time, in many yeshiva communities, people are actually looking to hear forbidden. And I can attest, sometimes I've gone to rabbis hoping, for whatever psychological reasons, that they would say it's forbidden. I think that's there's a certain part, this important part of the yeshiva culture. And it's not only, it's not unique to our own time. The pietistic communities are looking for religious strictures. But by and large, Mekelim, rabbis who see the lenient side generally have a historical advantage over those who are more strict in their approach. Obviously, expertise is taken for granted, right? Jews who are serious about their commitment are looking for someone who has the knowledge base to answer seriously. But the key component, which is what I wrote about, and it's key because it's the trickiest thing, and the examples that I gave about why we take risks as a people on halachot, they're much more dangerous, if you will. Some of the tshuvot of Rav Moshe Feinstein, for example, about disregarding civil law marriages, conservative marriages. These are very, very serious and on some level radical positions. Talked about the fact that no one thinks twice about selling their chametz. The Jewish people is willing to take halachic risk, and what I argued in this short article that I gave to you is that the most intangible yet critical factor in our historical judgment of whom to accept is just that, is a question of whom and not what, is the issue of Yirat Shamayim, is the issue of getting a sense. And I tried to describe that which is ultimately undescribable. I think last year when we were talking about Jewish education, we stressed the experiential component, that most of what we're trying to teach when we teach religion is something that you can't really teach, at least not in a classroom scenario, or at least in a traditional classroom scenario. Yirat Shamayim is something you have to see and experience and feel for yourself. It's one of these things, I forgot who said it about pornography, that I can't define it, but I'll know it when I see it. Stuart Potter? Okay, and it was Justice. There you go. Okay. Potter Stewart, okay. Okay. So he also knew what it was. In any case, Lahavdil, I should say, when talking about Yirat Shamayim, there's one interesting point that one should not confuse for Yirat Shamayim. That the Sri De Esh made, I didn't get a chance to look at the Hebrew, but Rabbi Sperber quoted in the English article that I recommended that you look at. He says, he's talking about the Sri De Esh's article, on allowing for Benot Mitzvah celebrations, celebrate Bat Mitzvah. And he says as follows, neither should be forgotten that even those who take the permissive side with respect to a new custom of celebrating Bat Mitzvah, and I would add, whatever else the case might be, do so with hearts beating piously. Being a Mekel is not equivalent with lacking Yirat Shamayim. And being from, so to speak, or Machmir, is not equivalent with having Yirat Shamayim. Yirat Shamayim is ultimately, again, it's something that is almost futile for me to try to describe, but in the article that I had you read, I tried in the short, very short situation that these articles come in to give an example about the fear that a person has to have in terms of tampering with Dvar Hashem, and also with sociological, with clear appreciation of the sociological ramification, the tremendous importance of the proper functioning of the Jewish people. Right? A person who has that requisite fear, the Jewish people, I think, is willing to follow. And I think that's the primary determinant in who becomes the acceptable posek. Which, and there are other determinants, obviously. In other words, are we saying that it's only one person or three, five people with Yirat Shamayim in a generation? Obviously not. But my point is that without that element, the person does not stand a chance as being acceptable. In other words, anyone we put forward as someone who is halachically progressive, right, if that person has not worked on themselves to the point where they exhibit Yirat Shamayim, not artificially, but organically exhibit Yirat Shamayim to the point that it's perceivable by a large section of the Jewish people, then we've lost the game to start with. Which was my question I asked at the end of class last week. So, do these halachic articles help? Right? In other words, the frustration that Rabbi Shapiro writes about, or I wrote a discussion much less sophisticated about religious censorship. I gave a talk a few years back. It's on our website. Also delving into the halachot, questioning whether religious censorship is not outdated for halachic reasons, and giving an halachic analysis, again, very small level, more in line with what Rabbi Sperber was doing in his article, decrying the situation of Psak Halacha in general. The question is, do these articles help historically? Right? Does our crying out, and even if we put the best halachic presentation possible, right, is that really where we should be spending our time? And I think that one of the mistakes of modern Orthodoxy has been trying to put forward teshuvot, trying to fight in the arena of halacha in such a way by bringing more sources. In other words, the Haredi posek has his sources for prohibiting X, Y, or Z. We're going to bring a million sources why he's wrong. I think it's a failed venture from the beginning. Because if the posek, that the progressive posek, is not someone who's bringing with him the type of stature, again, the type of Yirat Shamayim that can compete, then I think that there's historically nothing that can be gained. Again, you can convince anybody who's willing to read the Tshuva, but the bottom line is there's always going to be answers. You can always find, there have been a lot of poor halachic papers and Tshuvot written. And there's no shortage of people who are willing to write arguments why the people who are wrong are in fact right. The question is, historically, who's going to be accepted? And ultimately, I don't think that it's a question of facts and halachic argumentation. Yeah, Arya.
How do you feel that the nature of the posek has been affected by the fact that there's so many more learned people in the world in general?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a good question. The question of the mass spread, it's not a good term, but the spread of sophisticated learning. So the people, many more people now understand enough to either answer their own questions or be more critical. I mean, I don't know what angle you're asking from, or be more critical in the reception of the answers they get, or in posing the questions. It's a good question. I'm not sure that it directly bears, or at least I should say, I haven't seen it directly bear on what I'm speaking about.
My thought process behind the question is that people sensing that fear that the posek has when writing their psak, I think works more in a community where they have to rely on the posek for their knowledge. Mm-hmm. But if you're in a community where, okay, I can look that up also, and like, oh, actually, I read this article that you didn't quote in
right.
here, you know,
right.
or I have this realm that's not, it's just that fear, I don't know if it does the same thing for those people.
Yeah, I mean, I want to take the other question. I'm going to address partly what you said.
Okay. If I'm understanding correctly, you're saying in the long run, historically speaking, the articles by what we would call minor authorities nowadays are not going to be as impactful as the media postings we would call political. In such a case, I mean, the way a Posek really receives his, I guess, ability to give up stock to a wide range of people is by giving his scale up as wide range to people and then getting more and more and more. And it's sort of like the Gadol HaDor is decided upon by the Am. So if the people don't write, like if we come to the sort of example, with audio doesn't write things, then there's no chance of him ever getting to the level where he's going to be considered a Posek. On the other hand, if he does, then he can be considered a Posek for a significant part of the population. In which case, I don't necessarily see that type of argument looking backwards is helpful in any way. I see it as kind of the thesis of the whole process in terms of saying, well, if I'm not on the level of the Rambam in 200 years, that's not worth it. Or if not on the level of Rosh Hashanah 200 years, it's not worth it. If I'm not seen as being on the same level as Rosh Hashanah 200 years, it's not worth it. Then it's kind of a problem in terms of saying, okay, there'll be just one Posek for each door, and you know, the more Haredi wins, because that's going to have, numbers wise, that's going to be the person who has the biggest following. And therefore, you know, modern orthodoxy will pretty much cease to exist. I see the issue possibly being in that we shouldn't have as many shooting in terms of quantity that are going out of there now, which is possible. But not necessarily saying the effort is futile.
Yeah, so.
And that sort of came across. I don't know if that
okay, was yeah, I'm not sure. Perhaps it didn't come across exactly correctly, at least the way I meant to come across. First, I mean, there's two things I would respond to. Number one, when you say not worth it, the question is, what's it? In other words, is it worth it for Rabbi Shapiro to give such a tshuva so that Shira Chadasha has their ability to do what they need to do? Perhaps it is. You know, is it worth it for Rav Aviner to, you know, be in contact with all sorts of people who is? I'm sure it is. What I'm looking at is the historical impact. I'm not looking at if you're not the Rambam, so don't bother. But I am saying that there are a lot of people who are writing things that historically will have very little impact. And I think it's important if we're looking at a progressive strategy to bear that in mind, to bear in mind that how does one succeed historically? There's another thing, there's a very important point that you made which doesn't reflect what I'm saying at all in terms of the majority wins, it's winner-take-all type of situation, which is certainly not the case. I mean, there are many post-scheme who will have historical impact. Just as in the previous generation, there were many post-scheme that had historical impact. The question is, you know, are we going to be able to have progressive post-scheme at least among that number? And the critical issue that I see is Yerat Shamayim. There's another issue that you raise, which goes somewhat into Ariel's question. You pointed out that people have to be asking the questions. As for a Posek to become a Posek, people have to be asking the questions. Which is another drawback that I think that modern orthodoxy has against it. And the greater amount of learning may actually have a negative impact, paradoxically, on that. In fact, I forgot who said it, that there's a trend, I think last year someone, one of the students mentioned that there's a trend among some modern Orthodox or Zionist poskim to work through the tshuva with you. That's sort of a back and forth where it's a process that he gives you the options and the sources and you discuss them with. All of these trends actually weaken the ability of the posek to become a historical figure, to have that sort of, both in terms of his own shimush, as well as in terms of his authority, in terms of the numbers of people that do turn to him. All of these are relevant. Does that paint a gloomy picture? Perhaps it does. At the same time, I think that if it paints a picture that the obstacles are too great, I think there are other strategies that modern Orthodoxy can follow if it wants to have to impact upon the highly conservative trends that exist, again, small c, conservative trends that exist in Orthodoxy today, two of which are operating more in the area outside of halacha, I think ideology and hashkafar areas, that we don't realize how great an impact they can have, not only on hashkafar, but also on halacha. And connected to that, the second strategy is what type of questions whoever we ask, and obviously we have to be asking the questions to be involved in the development of halacha, asking, answering, being involved in the halachic process, and not simply doing whatever we want or not caring or opting out because we're not getting the answers we want. The type of questions that are asked to the post, like the sort of expectations that he feels from the tzibur, do impact on a posek. I was told of Rav Yitzhak Abadi, who was a very interesting posek, primarily in the Syrian community. He was a mashgiach in Lakewood, very interesting fellow, and was in Israel at a kollel here. He was a ben bayit by the Chazon Ish in Israel. He's from Israel, and he was in Lakewood, very connected to the Syrian community in New York. Was here for, I think, 15 years, moved back to New York. Very, very interesting. It's very maverick. A lot of his positions are highly unusual. In any case, some of the people in the Syrian community told me that one of the reasons he became such a maverick is because sort of questions and expectations that community members that he had exposure to kept on asking him, which created a certain sense of independence and need to go further than other poskim. Just give you a brief example, even though it's not so representative of his tshuvot. He has a shortened version of Birkat HaMazon, which is essentially one paragraph. He gives it out, he encourages people to say it, and he holds lechatchila. He says that, you know, people are not going to have kavana for, you know, the full 2 to 5 minutes it would take us to read the entire Birkat HaMazon with kavana. So if you give them a paragraph, you have a better chance. And he has all tshuva about why that's the case. Again, that's responding to a certain set of, if you know the people in the Syrians in Brooklyn, very no-nonsense, Rabbi, I can't say this, right? In terms of Birkat HaMazon, Rabbi, I can't say this, right? Now, the rabbi can go back and say, well, that's all there is. And sometimes that's appropriate. And in terms of the articles that we saw, both Rabbi Sperber and Rabbi Lichtenstein say, you can't, it's a great quote from Rabbi Lichtenstein, you can't make a travesty. What was the thing? It says it much better than I can say it. You cannot make a travesty of a din to relieve a personal crisis. In the case of a personal crisis, having kavana for 2 minutes is not quite on the level of a personal crisis for most people. But there are limits, which again goes into the area of Yirat Shamayim. Another quick example, I should have looked this up before class, I forgot to do so. If you look at the at Rav Moshe Feinstein's tshuva about using brushing teeth on Shabbat, and compare that to the Shemirat Shabbat on brushing teeth on Shabbat. Shemir Shabbat, as you know, even the Sort of Neuvert, is based on the Piskei Din of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Now, Rav Moshe Feinstein, if you look at everything he says, basically says it's forbidden, and finds a way to do it anyways. And then they go to the liquid toothpaste, and I don't remember all the details of the tshuva, but he basically says a big problem, but finds a way to allow it in some way. But Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says, if you look at the footnote, it's basically permissible, but since it's not such a big deal, don't do it anyways. What's the difference? The difference is, when Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was writing 30, 40 years ago in Israel, toothbrushing was not as regular a habit as it is in America. The American community wanted to brush its teeth on Shabbat. Rav Moshe Feinstein found a halachic way to allow it. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach even didn't see it as a major halachic issue, felt there was no need to permit it because there was no great social cost at doing so. Yeah?
There's another thing determinant that for influence on halacha, which has changed. Not only a lot of people who are learned today, today's books are much more available, and much more importantly, databases, computerized. Meaning, I would take an example as Avraham Yosef, one of his strongest abilities. He can quote,
anything.
But as soon as you have a place to shoot, and you have people that specialize in these places, I don't have to look random on a computer, I can also go through to articles. I have this advantage. So I think this is the thing. I think that this will determine the Yirat Shamayim, in the sense that maybe Yirat Shamayim is a necessary trait, but most important is your ability to encompass Torah in you. Now, as soon as you have these tools,
meaning, what do you mean, encompass Torah?
But as soon as memory can be dependent on computers and specialized articles and whatever, so a different type of genius should be. It's not like memory, but your ability to kind of pull out some sort of either analysis or people that have more hashkafa that they can infuse halacha. So I think you might see a different type of posek.
Could be. I mean, there's always, back in the Gemara, there was a discussion what's greater, what's called the Okeh Chavim versus the Sinai, someone who has this great big Kiut. Even with what's available, on the computer, a person who has it at their fingertips has an advantage. But I would grant that, again, we're dealing with a subset of people who have high level of competency and knowledge. And the question is not people who don't have that competency and knowledge. The question is, who do you choose among the people who have that competency and knowledge? And that's what I'm addressing. Yeah.
How are you supposed to think of one rabbi to have a relationship with an article of time? Because I mean, that would suggest that maybe there is a sense to learn more and choose different things that sort of are more acceptable to you.
Yeah, I'm not sure the question of to what extent should one have or shouldn't one have is so relevant to our discussion. I mean, again, I could discuss it with you privately, but the question is, to what extent is that the case today? And I think, again, with mass communication, it's less and less the case. How does that impact one way or the other? Again, I'm not sure. It's like Ariel's question. There are definitely some sociological changes going on without very, at least to me, very obvious implications in this particular question. I want to move on. I only have two classes after this. I want to finish at least what I planned, or most of what I planned to do for this evening. I want to move on a little bit to Rav Lichtenstein's article, as well as comparing his article to Rabbi Sperber's article, and as well as another article that I did have you read from Rav Lichtenstein called Is There an Ethic? No, that's not what it's called. I have here, Is There an Ethic Outside of Halakha? But I think it's really called, Does Judaism Recognize an Ethic Outside of Halakha? In any case, it's in the second volume of Leaves of Faith. It was originally written a long time ago in a collection of articles edited by Marvin Fox for Brandeis. In any case, one of the things that I wanted us to think about in Rav Lichtenstein's article is the question of the subjectivity, the legitimate subjectivity of a posek. The other thing that I wanted to speak to you about, which draws also on the article from for the other two articles that I mentioned, is meta-halachic agendas in the halakha. First of all, in terms of subjectivity, Rav Lichtenstein, first of all, draws this sort of, it's really a straw man as much as a caricature of an opposing position, which is interesting, right? Cardoza mentions similarly, said that, you know, from a long time, he, from based on his yeshiva background, thought this to be the case, that a posek basically collects data like a computer and spits out the answer based on a set formula that, you know, if you have, you know, this variable versus that variable, and the person, or the, even Rabbi Sperber mentioned certain income levels, it's like the tax, you put their income level into the computer also, right, how old they are, and you come out and there's only one teshuvah. So Lichtenstein forcefully answers that that's not the case. But he points out that that has to be based on some sort of logic. In other words, why shouldn't it be that way? How is it that halakha should not be similar to medicine, if you will, that ultimately there's one correct answer, and the question is how good the doctor is in terms of diagnosis and prescription. And even that's my analogy, not his. The question could be raised, you know, you go to the best practitioner of halakha, and the better they are at diagnosing the question and prescribing the answer, the closer they can come to the ultimate correct answer. So Lichtenstein points out, first of all, that the notion of Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim, and the fact that even a physician that's defeated still has the status, again, of Gufei Torah, of a body of halakha, and it can be used in a time of need. Meaning, they're both operative options, right? If there's an argument, we take one side of the argument as the law, the other side is still operative, meaning they're both legitimate interpretations of what the correct action is supposed to be. Once you recognize such a thing, you're saying, well, there's the same exact problem. The two rabbis, or Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, if you will, are addressing the exact same situation, and both of them are considered Gufei Torah, both of them are considered bodies of Torah. Obviously, what brought them to different answers is their subjectivity, and that is viewed as obviously legitimate. So therefore, there's room for subjectivity, or perhaps it's expected and understood. And we'll speak more about this in 2 weeks' time, the interplay between a posek's hashkafa and his piskei halakha. But all of that is legitimate within certain criteria. The interesting question Rabbi Cardoza alluded to, or asked something similar to, I think it was last week, in terms of an ethic that's completely outside of halakha. In other words, we'll talk about this a little bit more very shortly. Especially Rabbi Sperber, but also Rabbi Lichtenstein speak about meta-halachic questions coming from the Torah itself. Meaning they're not speaking about an ethic outside of Jewish sources, coming from outside of Jewish sources. The question is when we are influenced. Rav Lichtenstein raises the point, well, when a rabbi is influenced by the culture around him in coming to his decision, is that part of his legitimate subjectivity, or is it not? Or is it something they simply has to get rid of? I don't know if it's a required careful reading. Anybody get the answer to that? Yeah.
Rabbi, is a situation that, of course, you want to be very cautious about accepting. But if he's really...
So what did he say? What did Rabbi Lichtenstein say?
Okay.
he gives this beautiful, what to me was a beautiful analogy of the graft. You remember that? I'm sorry, you read it. You remember the graft? Where's the graft? Yeah, thank you. It's on page 8. Right. You're reading it tonight. You're going to memorize it. Right. What are the implications of that, as of the analogy? He's saying it's, sorry?
I'm a soft
type of Jesus. Right, okay, very good. At the bottom, very bottom of page 8, very bottom of page 8, he says as follows, when he's talking about this issue, he says, as the body rejects certain grafts, so the soul, and the nobler the soul, the more selective its system. But the other side of that is what? That some grafts take, right? In other words, there are cultural baggage, if you will, cultural influences that are legitimate for a true posek to incorporate. The question is ultimately not whether it's foreign or not. Obviously foreignness makes it more suspect. But the question really is, at least if I'm reading it correctly, is whether it's organically compatible. I use the word organically with emphasis. Not artificially compatible, but organically. And it's, again, in terms of the beautiful, at least I feel it's a tremendously beautiful analogy, that you can't graft things that organically don't work together. Okay? So not only is it legitimate for a posek to be subjective, I think it's hard to argue with that. At least according to Rav Lichtenstein, it's also legitimate for a posek to include within the subjectivity compatible foreign elements. Question is, going back to the other emphasis that I wanted you to see in the article, what are legitimate meta-halachic agendas and where do they come from? Right? The stress in both articles were on human needs. Right? Clearly, those are not the only agendas. What are some of the phrases that were being thrown around? It's very interesting, by the way. I said there's another article that I didn't have you read from Rav Lichtenstein about ethic outside of halacha. Many of the sources that Rabbi Sperber quotes in his article, you can find in that article as well. I mean, you can almost expect them. But what are some of the phrases that both of them mention that one sees in the halacha as these catchphrases that define this sort of meta-halachic humanistic agenda? Well, what do you remember? What sort of phrases did you see? Hefzid Gadol, right? Which is based on another catchphrase, Chasa HaTorah Mamon Yisrael, right? What else? What other phrases? Sorry? Pikuach Nefesh, Rav Lichtenstein said, as the ultimate, although it's almost, you're not really going far beyond halacha proper. What
else?
Darche Shalom, what else? Gadol Kavod HaBriyot, right? Darachea, Darche Noam, right? All these phrases set up, not the phrases, the concepts, set up an agenda which, according to both Rabbi Sperber and Rabbi Lichtenstein, creates a context in which the posek is understood to operate. In other words, these are factors that when a posek is entertaining any sort of question, he has to bear in mind. That doesn't always mean that they will be machriya, that they will be the deciding factor, but it means that they need to be kept in mind. Again, Lichtenstein is a beautiful phrase where he says not doing so, relating to something similar, is not just bad policy, it's bad halacha. In other words, both of these articles stress that this is part and parcel of the halachic system. If Rabbi Lichtenstein tangentially deals with foreign elements, his focus is clearly the same as Rabbi Sperber's, that this is part and parcel of Judaism. That Judaism understands that there is a need to deal with people in a certain way, and that failure to do so, or the quote Yerushalmi, is what led to the destruction of Yerushalayim. That judging according to the law, meaning, how did they both interpret that, based on earlier sources, as not looking to the exact situation, the needs of the people, the place involved, is a recipe for destruction, ultimately anti-halachic behavior. What's interesting is an interesting difference in terms as to where the source for these meta-halachic values come from. Right? There's a very, not very pronounced, but there's a difference between Rav Lichtenstein's presentation and Rav Sperber's presentation. When Rabbi Sperber, you may want to take a look at the very beginning of the article, especially note number 3, when Rabbi Sperber speaks about Derech Eretz Kadma LeTorah, he takes that very literally, in the sense that there is our moral intuition precedes how we relate to Torah law. Therefore, again, I don't know if you were sensitive to it, he says that a lot of the sources for such principles, or even particulars, speaks about Bikur Cholim. I don't know if you remember that discussion. And he says, you know, we're looking for sources for Bikur Cholim. And he says, where do we go? We go to Midrashim. We go to, you know, God went to visit Avraham Avinu on the third day of the Milah. And he says, where do you see that? Where does that come from? And his answer is, it doesn't really come from a straightforward analysis of Torah, but a sort of moral intuition, which HaKadosh Baruch Hu accepts as part and parcel of the Torah before the Torah is even given. At least that's the way, again, how I read Rabbi Sperber. I don't know if anybody read it differently than that. Rabbi Lichtenstein, I think, takes a more conservative line on this particular issue, where he sees certain, even though, again, in the article that I didn't have you read, he speaks about natural morality. He says the Torah definitely assumes a natural morality by throwing concepts at you and saying kadoshim to you. What is kadoshim to you? Well, you have to know what a kadosh is. Tzedek, tzedek tirdof. What's tzedek? Right? It's not spelled out for you, so why waste words? Right? Nonetheless, Lichtenstein feels that the authority for these meta-principles does not come from our moral intuition as much as grander directives set out by the Torah. Right? Such as, what are the two big moral directives that he speaks about? Anyone remember? What I just mentioned. Kedushin to you. Right? Echoing the Ramban famous discussion over there. What else? I heard. Yeah, as a sita yashar v'atov, right? They should do that which is straight and good, right? So again, the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu invokes these statements without really defining what they are, he understands as that which is developed by Chazal through meta-halachic agendas, yeah.
There's something about the point that strikes me that I like it. But at the same time, there are many things in Torah that are said that could have used a lot of definition that only gets defined in the Torah Shabbat. So it could be that these concepts and ideas are headlines, and their entire definition and meaning is only to be contained in Torah Shabbat.
Right, they could be. But in fact, the development of Shabbat Pe is also very outline oriented, and I think that's his point. On the side, it's very interesting that certain halachot have extensive development in the halachic literature, and other halachot do not. Which is a whole different study, because it's clearly not limited to these principles that we're talking about. But I think in both of the articles, again, if I read them correctly, would tell us that these, in fact, were not developed in the same way as Cheskat HaBatim, or Elul Metziyut, was developed. In any case, regardless of what the source is, in both these articles you see the tremendous importance placed on these meta-halachic agendas. Historically, again, neither rabbi, in fact, what Rabbi Sperber says is, in turning away from these meta-halachic principles, we're moving away from our tradition. Right? His argument is not that we should be mechadesh, that we should do something new, but rather that we should do something old. That we have a tradition which includes meta-halacha, and for whatever reasons, and we're going to talk about the reasons next week, but for whatever reasons, we've veered away from it. Right? Again, one can agree or disagree. Rav Lichtenstein is more conservative in this approach. He's not as outraged. He says, yeah, it's a problem. It's a problem that there is greater reluctancy to come out with far-ranging halakha that responds to some of these issues. But he says that it still exists. Right? What are the two examples that he gives of poskim who are still entrenched in the meta halacha, that are willing to appreciate and use the humanistic agenda as it should be? Anybody remember who they are? Could guess if you don't. Sort of fairly obvious in the previous generation. I don't remember. Rav Moshe Feinstein is one. Right? Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, right? All you have to do is backtrack a few minutes back to my discussion here. That has nothing to do with brushing teeth, but he cites these two examples. He might have added the Tzitz Eliezer or Eliezer Wallenberg. The question is, who is there now? Right? And by the way, when he mentions these examples, he's overlooking all sorts of people. He's speaking when he speaks about Rav Moshe Feinstein or Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, he's speaking about people that are recognized across the spectrum. And perhaps part of the reason they were recognized across the spectrum is because they incorporated what we've been discussing as an important part of their repertoire. The question is, I think it's a legitimate question. The truth is, Rav Lichtenstein wrote the article. When did you write this article? No, it's fairly recent, so yeah. I can't say that it's a question of who wrote it first or not. But I think the question is, are there people like this coming up in this generation of people who will be recognized across the board? And one can attribute it to all sorts of other factors. But be that as it may, whether that's the case or not, I think Rabbi Sperber is correct that poskim who are making historical impact, at least from our short-range perspective, seem to be veering further away from acceptance and incorporation of many of these meta-halachic agendas. As I said, next week we're going to delve into some of the reasons for that in greater detail.